How did I get to this point in my life? Like most of the rest of us on 9/11, we were going about our daily business very normally. I was sitting in my office at that time at Bob Jones University in the admissions department. I was the assistant to the director of admissions. And I got a phone call. And I said, "You got to be kidding me." It was this that couldn't have happened. And then the second one, and then the third one, and then Pennsylvania. And at that time, I already had an inkling of what was going to happen, because in the summer of 2001, I was actually promoted to Navy captain. And yes, brother, Captain Bly. And so there's been that bit of humor in my career from when I was commissioned, and it was always Captain Chaplain Bly. So now we have an interesting oxymoron, if you understand the history of Captain Bly and Mutiny on the Bounty and so forth. But I was promoted to 06, and then the expectation was is I was actually going to take on a new position in the Pentagon, and I was actually scheduled to go the last 2 days of September and the first 2 days of October and to transition into a new billet that we were standing up on the joint staff, working directly for the chairman and indirectly for the Secretary of Defense. So I knew that was coming. But I wasn't supposed to be there until the end of September. And I just said, I'll bet it's going to be before then. So I got a call Thursday that basically said, "Don't try to fly. Pack your bags and be in Northern Virginia on Monday and check in Tuesday morning." So I actually did that. And for the next 3 years, I actually was on the joint staff in the midst of all of this, answering questions at the level of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense, diffusing some things. And yet at the same time, again, I was like most every other American. I had no idea what Islam was. I barely knew how to use the words that are associated with Islam, Muslim, what's the difference, Islamic, and all of the permutations of those two words that people were using, many of which were inaccurate in their use. And I didn't know the difference, but the rest of us didn't either. Very few people in the administration, very few people in the U.S. government had a clue. Why? Well, it goes back to something that occurred back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And we began this transition away from the normal study of world history to the study of Western civilization. And when that transition took place, we basically blinded ourselves to the largest portion of human history. And so as a consequence, that was the Middle East, and the common phrase in the Pentagon was they're just a bunch of ragheads riding around on camels. Assuming that there was nothing intelligent that ever came out of that whole area of the world in terms of humanity and history they didn't know what a book was, and they're just the perception that global ignorance existed in that part of the world and anything sort of east of the Black Sea. And yet that's not the truth. And had we known that and had we studied it, I knew a little bit about it because I did have world history when I was in high school, and it dates me, I was 1966. But that was so long ago, I had forgotten most of that stuff. We did study, the history of China and so forth and so on, but it was at a fairly cursory level by the time it got to the point where I was being punished by those courses, as we all were during those days of high school, right? So I said, what am I going to do? How am I supposed to answer these questions? And so what that demanded of me was that I begin a diligent study of this. And you'll see here in a couple of minutes, I'll explain how I got to where I am right now, because I had to go through a very careful process of determining what I was going to read, and because there was too much to read, and I had to figure that one out. Now, let me kind of hitchhike on something that Pastor had said in the opening remarks. When you think about a Muslim, all right,
a Muslim comes to know the Lord the same way each of us did. It was the presentation of the gospel that the Holy Spirit used to break our hearts and for us to see the need of a Savior. And it's no different. And therefore, when you ask the question, well, Muslims are hard to reach, what you're actually saying there is that God can't do that job. God can reach any individual with the gospel that's been properly presented, and He doesn't see any distinction in those individuals, no matter where they came from, where they are in their lives, what they're doing in their lives, etc. Every Muslim is just as easily reached with the gospel as anyone else is. All God expects of us is two things. And I'm sure that when I say this, you're going to go, I remember that passage. And some of you go, I'm not sure I know what it is. But we have two tasks. Plant the seed and water, right? And who has the the third part of that is a responsibility? God. He brings the increase. It's not my job to do that. My job is to take the word that I know and communicate it again, somebody else communicates it, and I water on the seed that he planted, he or she planted, and then God chooses to use it as he chooses. So as you take a look at this issue of Muslims, there's no reason to be threatened by them, as, you know, intellectually or whatever. Now, the only reason why you would feel threatened is because you're not confident in your own relationship with the Lord. That's the only thing that keeps us from witnessing to anybody, is because we're not certain about who we are in Christ. Because if we have a confidence in the Lord, it's not difficult to share the gospel. It really speaks more to who we are than anything else. I'll stop preaching. I'll get on to where I'm supposed to go. Okay? So, but, I mean, remember that. I mean, the Muslims are no more difficult to reach than anyone else is. And if I had my choice, I would be sitting out there and somebody else would be doing this, because this is not something that I selected for myself, but in the providence of God, this is where I ended up doing what he has tasked me to do. And I do it because I love what he wants me to do more than anything else. And so does he sometimes give us tough rows to hoe? Yes. But they're neat. And whoever introduced me, thank you for graduating me early. I don't have my doctorate yet, but actually Brenda and I are getting ready to move out to Arizona, and I'm going to finish up my doctorate of ministry and start teaching at International Baptist College and Seminary and do modules at other schools and so forth. And then, Lord willing, I'll get through all the academic work, get the dissertation out of the way, and actually I can claim that term, but in that title. But one day, in the meantime, I'm just Captain Bly. So, and Dad, which is more important. All right, what is Islam? As you ask yourself this question, this sentence answers the mail. It is a comprehensive system of thought and life. It is a new civilization. Now, when I say a new civilization, it's not new in the sense of new to human history, because it's been around since 600 AD. It's new to us, and we need to realize it is a different, new as in different in kind. It's a different civilization that Muslims desire to impose upon the rest of the world because of a few things that we'll look at in a minute. Now, what I deal with is I try to deal on a fact-based approach to this, all right? Not my opinions, not the opinions of others, and I try to work off of official public websites and official documents as it relates to Islam. And it's because of that I can do this in a very relaxed manner, because I've double-checked my sources. I've had some Muslims look at me and go, you're dangerous because you tell the truth about us and you're not mixing any metaphors or you're mixing it with opinions. All right, so when I started to work through this, and I had to fundamentally ask myself the question, what on earth do I study? What do I read? Why should I read what I read? And so I worked through this, and so as you look at all the literature that's out there that relates to this subject, they're going to basically fall into one of these four categories. Now, the brochures that are on the back table fall into the third category. All right? Patrick, I know very well. He's a Pakistani. He's trained in Oxford. Brilliant man. Loves the Lord. He's an Anglican, but loves the Lord. Why? Because he grew up where persecution was real, and the relationship with Christ is real for those people. And so he's the one that has written them. So I say that for you because they're for your information purposes, okay? Those pamphlets are there for that purpose. They're for information as you try to get a hold of this. You don't want to take them and hand them or use them to defend or defeat a Muslim, right? But so you understand what you're hearing, even in the news and other places, what's going on. But I try to stick exclusively in this category when I do presentations. Because I want to be able to convey to people what they tell their own people is the truth. So this is truth for Muslims is another way of describing it. Right, so here's what my learning curve was. So I had to learn it in its own original context, chronological context. I had to learn about these sources, and I've worked through each of these. And as it relates to this one, and as I said in the Sunday school, the Quran is not compiled chronologically. It's compiled based on the length of the chapter. And so that makes the Quran very difficult to read. And so once you understand that, and in the 8-hour session, I actually have the chronology, and I can send that to you if people ask for it, so that you can actually read it if you were to choose to. Now, let me just... All of us find reading daunting, all right? Let's just be honest, all right? And the larger the book, the more daunting it becomes. So, as you actually answer the question, how long is the Quran, it's actually shorter than the New Testament. Even though the book looks daunting, it's daunting because there's a lot of white space in because there's Arabic and there's the English. But it's a very small document, relatively speaking, and it actually reads fairly quickly. And there is an actual narrative. Now, you have to flip back and forth because there's not a Quran that you're going to find that's printed, that's published in a chronological order. So this is what I did, and so I began with the Quran, and I went to the biography of Muhammad, the Hadith authors, Islamic jurisprudence, and then I read Ibn Khaldun, who's a classic Islamic historian. His piece is extremely exciting to read. I mean, literally, because it's a very fascinating history of mankind and humanity. Now, this is what the Muslim Brotherhood is. Now, every Muslim who is in any position in any government, from the local level to the federal level, is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. They vet their people very, very carefully. And they take this motto very seriously. Make sure you get that one fully in your head. So anytime you see a Muslim standing with any member of the federal government, state government, local government, he is one of these guys. And that's what his objective is. To impose its law on all nations, on every community. All right? This is typical if you're going through the rest of the world. This is what a church looks like through North Africa. Hundreds of them on a regular monthly basis are burned. So it's a religion of peace. And the Islamic Circle of North America is one of their educational arms, and they have a very, very significant Sharia education campaign that's been going on in the nation. This is going back a couple of years, but it's still nevertheless the case. And the whole objective is to help people to understand that Sharia law is completely compatible with U.S. law. And it really should replace U.S. law. And so this is what some of their publications look like and how they present themselves. This is just a thumbnail sketch of what's actually going on in the administration and what are they doing. And, you know, you can go and Google each of these individuals and look at which department of the U.S. government they are actually sitting in very, very senior positions. And imagine if you have somebody that's dealing with this at the State Department or Homeland Security or the Department of Defense, and we're trying to figure out how to prosecute this war that we're in. All right. So, now, how do you understand what a Muslim then, therefore does, and how does he interact? If you go back to what I said this morning and understanding that a Muslim has a moral obligation to lie. Now, I can't get my head wrapped around that because I can't figure out how I could do that because there's too much Christianity that's running around in my brain that just runs 180 degrees of that. So, how do they live? Well, it literally begins this. It begins at the very personal level. You know, one man against his brother, a brother against his family, family against the clan against the tribe against the nation, sect against the hypocrite and the apostate, and me, the individual, and the ummah, that is all the rest of the Muslims, against the U.S., Israel, the West, and all infidels. That's how they operate. If there's a conflict between them at a lower level, if the issue is Islam against America or against Israel, they put that aside. They put that conflict aside for another day, and then they fight the fight that's there at the higher level. And you can see what's going on. We've seen this in Afghanistan. We saw it in Iraq, and we're going to see it, you know, in our local communities. So here is where we're going to go this morning. It's a comprehensive system of thought, an ideology, a new civilization, not primarily a religion. Right? Islam is not primarily a religion. It is a complete and comprehensive system of thought, ideology, within which is a religion. It's a sub-component of the overall construct, the system of thought. For us Americans, Sharia law is foreign law, and there's plenty of language in the Constitution, Article 6 in particular, that lays out the issue that the law of the land in the United States is not Sharia law. And when you understand Sharia law, you understand very quickly that it has principles and precepts associated with it that are in direct conflict with our law. Whenever you talk to a Muslim, understand that dualism dominates the conversation. They will lie to you. They have a moral obligation to lie to you because for them, something can be true and false at the same time depending on who they're talking to. That's not acceptable for us in the West. It's either true or false, and you operate accordingly. And when you're dealing with Muslims, understand that the dialogue is always one way. They're in project mode. They're not in listen mode because they've been schooled to not to listen to us and to not to absorb what we're saying because, as the Quran says, if they listen to us, they may move away from Islam. They may lose their faith in Islam. And so when you start to deal with any conversation, understand that there is no common ground between us and them. Everything has a yes and a no answer to it. Now, I have a friend who, David Hasifluk, who's been a missionary in Albania for 20-some years. And when I first met David here, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I was asking him about how do you do missionary work in an ostensibly Muslim country? And he said, it's real simple. Pray, meet people, and tell them about Jesus. He says, I don't worry about this. Because he says, I pray, ask the Lord, who does he want me to talk to? And then I tell him about Jesus. And that's it. Now, you can say, well, then we might as well just turn off the machine and go home. Well, that's true, except for the fact that we now have a problem in the United States, and we as citizens have a responsibility to the Constitution of the United States, and so we need to look at this. Okay, so, again, these are critical things for us. There is no golden rule. They have been given direct the instructions. There is no integrity in Islam because there's no word in the Arabic that allows for that word to be even communicated. And this whole idea of lying has a concept of sacred deceit associated with it. So how does this actually flesh out in terms of some fundamental questions? Is Islam a religion of peace? Is there compulsion? Is it a violent religion? And the answers to those questions are yes and no. Now, isn't that a happy day? It depends on the answer depends on the person being spoken to and what are the circumstances. So, all right, so it is a religion of peace for Muslims, but it's not a religion of peace for non-Muslims. There is no compulsion unless you choose to ignore Islam, then there is compulsion. And is it a violent religion? No, if you are willing to live under all the rigor of Islam, but yes, if you choose not to live under the rigor of Islam. So they will say, well, it's a religion of peace. For me. There's no compulsion. For me. But they don't finish the sentence. And this is typical of the way that they go about this. Right? One of the most important ones is this one. Is Islam an Abrahamic religion? Again, the answer is yes or no. What do you mean by that question? All right? So, these are the three Abrahamic religions. What's the distinction between these two and this one? Pardon? Which son? Okay, and who are the two sons that you're referencing? Ishmael and Isaac, okay? Very good. Islam comes up through the lineage of Ishmael. Judeo-Christianity comes up through the lineage of Isaac. Now go back to your Old Testaments and take a look at that and ask yourself this question. When did the conflict between Islam and Judeo-Christianity actually begin? All right? All the way back there. So, is it an Abrahamic religion? Yes. But is it the same Abrahamic religion that we subscribe to? No. But they aren't going to talk to you about those things because now they're in hot water because then you ask, well, who did Abraham go up on the mountain with? Which mountain did he go up? What was the thing that he was supposed to slay? Et cetera, et cetera. The whole dialogue associated with it is vastly different. Now, when you hear words in the press, and you hear words like radical, extremist, moderate, etc., those are great words that have no meaning, right? Because when you look at radical, ask the question, radical to what or to whom? Extremist, again, relative to what or to whom, moderate, relative to, etc. And when you begin to wrestle with that, you go, oh, what does that really mean? All right, so when you take it a step further on this issue, and we kind of do a comparison between Islam and Christianity, and we kind of work ourselves through this and say, well, what then is a fundamentalist? Well, simple answer is a fundamentalist is somebody who believes something or about anything. And there are a set of fundamentals that every individual to which everyone adheres. I don't think that there's anybody sitting here that would be willing to get up on the roof and just jump because you're a fundamentalist. You fundamentally believe gravity works. And so as you think about life, there are hundreds of fundamentals of life that you subscribe to on a daily basis, and you don't even think about it. So answer this question. Who is not a fundamentalist? Nobody. We're all fundamentalists. It's the question of what fundamentals are fundamental to what you live by. So when you ask the question based on the source documents associated with the belief system, the structure of what they understand, etc., and the way they live, realize that at the end of the day, the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda are the real Muslims if the assessment is based on settled Islamic jurisprudence and history. Everybody else who is not basically in alignment and operating with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda is either a hypocrite or an apostate as it relates to Islam. Now, is that what you hear on the in the press on a regular basis? No. Why? Because it's not a function of this and this. When you ask the question this way, you come up with an entirely different answer. So is being a fundamentalist some kind of an evil moniker that's attached to anybody? No. It's actually a positive one because it says you believe something. Now, you know, my set of beliefs are based on a set of principles that are derived from a document or a set of documents, and if I live by them, I'm a fundamentalist. As it relates to just being an American, I am a fundamentalist. Why? Because I believe the Constitution, I believe what our founding fathers worked through, I believe the Declaration of Independence, the Northwest Ordinance, and all the documents that basically set up what it means to be an American. So I am an American, I'm an American fundamentalist, because I believe the Constitution is not some kind of an elastic document. That's not what it means to be an American. And we could go on and on with that. So as we think about this, you know, you've got to work through this, okay? And I have a slide that I show this evening that lays this one out that explains that proverb as well. So it's not just a religion, it's a complete way of life governed by Islamic law, the Sharia. And when you look at this, it's a political, economic, military, social, cultural, family, and religious system. Theology is subordinate to the requirement to adhere to the Sharia. So as we think about ourselves as Christians and we try to do the comparative analysis, how important is theology to Christianity? Now, it tells us how we live our lives in many of these areas, but the key is that when we start to work through this, it's a geopolitical ideology. It's a replacement religion and a replacement civilization. And so as you work through this and try to understand what it means to be a Muslim and what is Islam, again, it's ruled, governed by Islamic jurisprudence or Sharia law, not theology. Right? There is a theology within Islam, but it is a subcomponent of the overall system of thought. So when you work through these things and you begin to try to grab a hold of these terms and understand the definitions of them, this is helpful because, and this is what I had to do. I had to actually sit down, write on paper many of these terms, most of these terms, and finally get them planted in my head so I could use them properly. So I understood Islam using its terms, okay? The Ummah is the worldwide community of Muslims. It's the worldwide community of Muslims, right? Now, if I say it's the worldwide community of Muslims, what am I actually saying? All Muslims, where? Everywhere. Now, what does that do to things such as citizenship? They're a Muslim first and a citizen of some country second. So their allegiance is to Islam before their allegiance to a country. Now let that settle in your head for a minute and wrestle with that one. So wrestle as the issues of authority here within Islam, right? And again, you see these terms, Sirah, Hadith, Sunnah, and that's why the slides become important so you can go back and go, okay, all right, what did he say about this? What's this word mean? How do I understand it? How do I use it? I don't expect you to grab a hold of this. It took me multiple times through most of this stuff to begin to even be able to see straight. So, when you talk about the corpus juris, the legal system of Islamic law, you have all of this, right? And it derives in this order: the Quran, the Tafsir, the commentary, the biography, the words and deeds of Muhammad, jurisprudence, and then you end up with Sharia policy. One of the gentlemen asked me about this issue of Islamic law in the United States and it being used, and actually decisions have been made based on Sharia law. Yes. And they've put the nose of the camel under the tent under the guise of family law. Well, it's not national law. It's not, you know, tax law. It's just family law. Step one, step two, step three, step four. If they can gain acceptance at the family level, then they're going to push for the next level, and then it's going to eventually become parallel with and eventually replace U.S. law. So how do you grab a hold of the Quran and understand it in terms of the narrative? The Quran itself was revealed in basically four periods of time in the life of Muhammad. It began in Mecca, and there were three periods in his life during the Meccan period, and then when he migrated to Medina, and this wedge is deliberately red because this is the bloody section of the Quran. And you kind of have to know that because you have to know how Muslims are going to pick and choose the use of particular passages out of the Quran. Because if they just pick stuff out of here, it's real peaceful. It's nice. It's wonderful. Let's go, all of us become Muslims and sing Kumbaya. I don't know what that would be in Arabic, but basically, you know, you know, so that's what's going on. They will never quote from this if they're dealing with non-Muslims, because the message changes. All right. So how does their, and I put this in quotations to help us understand this. All right. When you look at the trilogy of texts, that is the Quran, the Sirah, biography or Sunnah of Muhammad, and then the Hadith. When you wrestle with, you know, how do you divide this? All right. And what it's all about? Well, Islam, if you will, in terms of Islamic text, is about 14% about Allah and about 86% of it deals with Muhammad. Right? So this would be, and this is a very rough equivalent, who is God and who is Jesus? All right? And then the relationship that exists between us and that. So when you begin to now deal with how does this break out, more specifically, as it relates to how much of their texts deals with the kafir or the non-Muslim, and how do they interact with the non-Muslim, you see the percentages. So 60% of their literature deals with how to deal with us, not how to be a Muslim and what is their relationship with Allah, but it's how to deal with us. And that should tell you something. So when we then take a look at this and we get into the sect issue within Islam, the Sunni, which is the majority, the Shia, and then the Sufi or the mystics and the Salafists, who are some of the earliest fundamentals within Islam, understand that this is only important to us for informational purposes. Because when we deal with this, we're an outsider to this. Right? Any conflict that might exist between the Sunni and the Shia, that's between them. It's like the little battles or the bigger battles that exist between a brother and a sister or two brothers or two sisters. Right? It's within the family. They will allow us to get derailed by getting involved in this, and therefore they win the battle because they take the high road and they win the external battle, which is more important. Now, when we look at this within the schools of law within Islam, there's the four primary in the Sunni realm, and there's the three primary in the Shia. And you go, oh, that's painful. It is, but it's not, because what is important when you do the analysis of this is that it doesn't matter what school of law is being cited, whether it's Sunni or Shia, at about a 95% level of equivalence, they all say the same thing about the same subjects. So you can't say, well, the schools of law, they all differ. Well, yeah, they do. Maybe about 5% of the data, and it's all in the now. And I say this, don't take this one to the bank. It's somewhat extraneous to the argument. But you know, if 95% of the legal agreements are in agreement across. Now, these are the four primaries in the Sunni side of things, and then you have the under the Hanbal, you have the Takfiri, and then the Wahhabists. Understand that if I work with this school of law exclusively, which is the most relaxed, the most benign, the most, you know, they don't beat the tom-toms as much as the Hanbalis do in their system. I can prove everything I need to about Islam that's disadvantageous to us from the Hanafi school of law. And don't even have to get into the Hanbal and Takfir and the Wahhabists. So that whole argument when you say, well, you know, it's all about the Wahhabists and the Takfiri. No. It's all about Islam. And you're just trying to use that as a means to confuse us and to get us confused about what's going on. So when we look at this, now we go into the legal structure and how do they get to the point where they get to this point where they actually do their evangelism, which is dawah, and they work through this whole issue of fatwas and what do you do with the 20th century, because Islam is very, very well defined and well refined in its legal prescriptions. If you go back to the days of Muhammad and you ask yourself the question, what kind of shoes did he wear? What do you think he wore in the desert? Sandals, all right? What do you think his primary means, and there's two answers to this question. What were his primary means of transportation? Walking. But if he was to have a means for transportation other than his 2 feet, what were they? Camel and horse or mule. Right? So, did Muhammad ride a camel? Not just, follow me here. Right? Did Muhammad ride a camel? Yes. Does that mean that every Muslim can ride a camel? Yes. If Muhammad did it, you can do it if you're a Muslim. Right? Now, roll things forward to the 20th and 21st century. How many of you got to church this morning on a horse, mule, or camel? You did? No, none of us did. How did you get here? Car, you know, four-wheel vehicle. Now, you're a Muslim. Did Muhammad drive a car?
No.
Can a Muslim ride a car, drive a car? No, because Muhammad didn't ride one. Therefore, as a Muslim, I can't ride one. Right? Now, you're laughing, and I don't blame you, but because of that, through the whole, all of human history, since 600 AD, they have been writing fatwas, or legal opinions, that answer the question, can a Muslim do things like that? And if there isn't a fatwa, a legal opinion that authorizes a Muslim to do something, he or she will not do it because either Muhammad didn't do it, or the ijma, or the consensus of the scholars is not in place that permits them to do so. Right? This is very important for understanding how does a Muslim live his life. And so there's a certain sense of fright, because if a Muslim does something that Muhammad didn't do or didn't approve of, it equates to sin in Islam. And so their whole lives are based on this intense adherence to a very prescriptive legal system. So Islam is a legal system within which is the religion, and from that is where we end up with the five daily prayers, each of which is very specific. There's no free flow prayer in Islam, period. You only pray the prayers that Muhammad prayed, or he was said to have prayed. So then we have the next thing in terms, and this is why it's somewhat complicated. Remember I said to you that the Quran is not compiled based on historical order? Well, you have to understand the historical order, because as Muhammad received the revelation from Gabriel, it occurred in over a period of time. And if you read the story, what you find is that, well, this one that he received early in Mecca seems to conflict with this one that he received when he was in Medina. What do I do? Well, Allah, well, he can lie. So is he lying? Is he scheming? Is he planning? What's he doing? And so over the course of time, they dealt with this issue of you can't get rid of a passage in the Quran, because after all, that came from Allah. But they actually worked through a process, accepting the fact that there was a progressive revelation in the Quran, and so it necessitated the repeal or the abrogation of certain laws. So the way you actually have to read the Quran, if you're trying to figure out authority within the Quran, is you have to read it from the last passage that was revealed to the first, because last mention is the final authority. So if something that was revealed at the end conflicts something that was revealed earlier, the message at the end is the one that rules. So now, do you understand why understanding Islam can be a little bit complicated? And that's why they throw all the responsibility onto the pastor or the imam's shoulders and say, make sure that you get this right, because if you tell us wrong and we do something wrong, we're in hot water with Allah. So there is this whole issue of scholarly consensus, and that's how it's developed over the course of history. And when there is consensus, that is, all the scholars in a given period of time dealing with a particular issue make a decision on a legal ruling, it is absolute and cannot be contravened or null. That means a decision that was made in the 1800s among the scholars is still on the books and cannot be contradicted. So if this thing rolls backwards in terms of understanding this. So think about all the rules that have been agreed to over the course of the last 1400 years and figure out what that means to in terms of living life under Islam. So here we go. This is one of these that's extremely important, all right? The issue of jihad is personally obligatory. Now this comes out of the book here, The Reliance on a Traveler that I mentioned this morning, which was written in the 1300s. Personally obligatory, must be met with effort and struggle to repel them by every possible means. So what are they doing? They're trying to repel us. Now, Qaradawi, who is among the Islamic scholars today, he is at the top of the food chain, right? If he says it and he concludes it, everybody just nods his head and goes, yes, sir. And look at this. All the schools of Islamic law, Sunni and Shia, and all the ancient and modern schools of jurisprudence agree. And this is dealing with the issue of jihad and the activities associated with jihad. So the fundamental question then becomes this. Is active military jihad a responsibility of every Muslim in the 21st century? Yes. If called upon, every Muslim will pick up the sword and engage in battle. Because there is absolute agreement regarding this. They all agree. And when he said this, and this is actually, he said it in a TV sermon from Qatar in 2006. Basically, that settled the issue of whether or not active military jihad was the responsibility for every Muslim. He affirmed that for all Muslims globally. So anybody that uses any other definition of jihad is just trying to, well, they're blowing smoke or trying to to avoid the truth. And since they're Muslims, of course they're going to try to do that. So this is what a Quran looks like if you have it chronologically ordered. All right, so you start with the 96th chapter, and then this is the way it goes. And then you get over here to the 9th and the 5th as it's compiled in the book. Now this becomes important, all right? So we've all probably heard this. There's no compulsion in religion in Islam, right? That's in, as it says here, chapter 2. But whoever seeks a religion other than Islam will never have it accepted of him, never accepted by Allah. That's in 3. Take not the Jew or Christians for your friends. And Hassan, who was the Fort Hood murderer, in his briefings that he was giving all over the Department of Defense, basically said this. All right, so here's another example. Whoever seeks religion other than Islam will never, you know, so if I don't seek Islam, it's not going to be accepted by, I mean, Allah's not going to accept me is what this really turns out to be when you read the rest of it, the context. Right? So fight and slay the unbelievers and those who disagree. Fight and those who believe not in Allah nor the last day as defined in, even if they are people of the book. So, am I the target of Islam? Yes. All right? And again, this was in Hassan's brief that he was conveying to the, you know, across the DOD back before he, you know, actually engaged in his effort at Fort Hood. What, Fort Hood? 5, 6, 7 years ago now. And he's now just finally getting to trial. And he has the issue. And notice, offensive jihad continued. I mean, this is how he titled his slides. So he, you know, he was following in the line. And so, and this is all over the press. I mean, so you can get there. So, now, here's the thing that if there was really any question as to where they were going, what they were going to do, we need to go back. And I was sitting in the Pentagon when these two documents were actually developed. And I said, what are you people thinking? So, these are the new Afghan and Iraqi constitutions. And so right at the very beginning, Islam is the official religion of the state and the basic source of legislation. The religious state is the sacred religion of Islam. Does that leave any room for Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, secularism, or whatever? No. No law can be passed. No law can be passed. No law can be passed. No law can be contrary to the beliefs and provisions of the sacred religion of Islam. So, what's the probability of freedom of religion in Afghanistan or Iraq? 0. All right? And so this is what, yes, this is where they're going. All right? Now, it would be easy if we say, oh, you know, No, so in addition to that, the Syrian constitution, the Jordanian, the Saudi, and the Egyptian constitutions, and this predates the Arab Spring, mind you, all have Islamic jurisprudence as the principal source for all legislation. Now, just to give you an idea of how this works, when I was in Iraq in 08, I think, I was in Baghdad, and I was dealing with a couple of issues, and there was a law going through the Iraqi parliament. And I can't remember exactly what the subject of it was anymore, but here's what happened. Al-Maliki said, we have to hold on the vote. So he went down and talked to Sistani, who was in southern Iraq. Then he went over to Iran and talked to the Shia, the other half of the Shia. And then he went over to Al-Azhar University in Egypt and said, am I okay with this? Does this meet the consensus of the scholars? He came back, told the parliament, he said, we can vote on this, we have the authority from the religious leaders to actually vote on this. You know, I kind of wish that our representatives and senators might check with some folks on some of the stuff that they write, and maybe they wouldn't vote on it. Never mind. Now, just how simple this really is, all right? This is a book, What Islam is All About, that seventh graders in the Islamic schools in America use. All right? And it addresses these issues, and the guy that actually wrote it is you know pretty prolific, and he's an American-born convert to Islam. All right, so we get what's being taught to these kids is these issues. Not a religion, but a complete way of life, governed by Islamic law. And so you can go out there and you can read it, and it's only about that thick, and it reads very quickly. This is a little bit more complicated, but it's actually used. It's basically the primer that they use when you go into law school as a Muslim. And you know, here's what, again, to come back to this, this is what the objective is of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. They have a memorandum that was admitted into U.S. District Court in Texas when they did the Holy Land Foundation. And it says this, the Ikhwan, or the Brotherhood, must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands, and I'll come back to that, in the hands of the believers so that it is eliminated and God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. Now, based on what I said this morning, as it relates to this issue of what is Islam and the use of the word of religion in this context, what are they actually saying to you? Islam will be made victorious over what? All religions. And what are they equating under the word religion? Christian. Americanism. The belief system. All right? Now, whose hands are being referenced here when you actually sit down and think this one through? Are they going to do this job themselves?
No.
Are they going to use other people's hands to do so? Whose hands do you think they're using? Elected politicians at all levels, all right? Local, county, state, federal. And so they're doing what they can to get elected and then to influence the individuals who are being elected. And all you need to do is, if you're, you know, for those of us that are, you know, voters in Virginia, look at what's transpired since the last election. Look what the current governor is doing, what he has already done, and you'll see where he's at. He is the tool of the Muslim Brotherhood. So this is us, all right? And this is extremely important for us to structurally understand what it means to be an American. And this is the power flow. This is the intended power flow as our founding fathers laid out. And they had a reason for it being this way. So it's we the people, everybody equally, the Constitution. And the Constitution is supposed to govern and direct and control. And then all this other stuff is beneath it down here. In other words, it has its place, but that's what it's all about. This, on the other hand, is what it looks like in Islam. It's the Sharia that's at the top of the pecking order. They do have the three elements of the government as defined within Islam. But it's the Sharia and the Sharia policy and then the people, because it dictates to the people, the men, and then the women, and then there's a large gap here that exists that separating this from the kafirs, the dhimmis, and other non-Muslims. Right? This is the way it looks in Islam. All right? And that's the end of it for this morning. So, I'm sure at this point, some of you are going, others are going, I can't figure this out yet, which is okay. But what I want you to be is a well-informed citizen. And you can take 90% of what I just gave to you, and you can absorb a little bit of it, take what's in those brochures back there, those pamphlets, and you can confront your local township people, and you ought to say, this is America. You know, this is not a, I'm not all about Sharia law. And by the way, these Muslims, they really can't be Americans. Because if you go back to where I was a few slides ago, and what is, to what does a Muslim adhere as his highest authority and his highest level of allegiance? Allah and Islam. Right? Now, and I take this seriously because I still, while I carry a blue card in terms of the U.S. military, I still have a responsibility to take my oath of office seriously. To what do I give my allegiance as an officer? The Constitution of the United States. And I will defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. All right? Am I a Christian? Yes, absolutely. And there's no conflict between my Christianity and my citizenship as an American. So, can a Muslim take an oath of office honestly? No. I leave you with that troubling thought. So, I'll close in prayer and then I'll turn it over to Pastor. Father, thank you for this morning and thank you for the day in which you've placed us. And Lord, you've placed us here for a reason. And you want us to be light. You want us to be salt in the world in which we live. And may we do so. And may we, as we have been guided and directed, to take our responsibility seriously and to pray, meet people, and tell them about Jesus. For that's what our task is. And Lord, even if this country becomes a country that's governed by Sharia, our allegiance is to you, and we will stand by that. We may stand in the gallery of those that are in Hebrews 11, and if that's the case, so be it. And Lord, we rejoice in who we are. We rejoice in who you are. We rejoice in the relationship that we have with you, and we rejoice in the fact that we have the privilege of having your word to give us the guidance that we need each and every day of our lives. In Christ's name I pray.